Amazing. Tonight, we're very, very, very lucky. Very, very lucky. We've done so many very interesting topics together. The Maharal we did last week, before then we did Rav Kook. Very, very, very interesting stuff. Tonight is no less important. It is incredible. But first, let me start off with a very, very small story. And the reason why, you will see, it will become quite evident. I love things where you have like a certain paradigm, and then there becomes a huge paradigm shift. What we're going to discuss tonight is a major paradigm shift in how to think about the Baal Shem Tov. And it all comes from this story. In 1978, after spending a month cajoling librarians and politicians in Ukraine, yeah, it's in the news a lot right now, Professor Moshe Rossman, who wrote an incredible, incredible book, which most of tonight is going to be based on, called Founder of Hasidim, A Quest for the Historical Baal Shem Tov. In 1978, he was in Ukraine. Oh my, Ukraine at that time. He writes, he says, you go into a library, you're expecting to find some sort of catalog? Ha ha ha, they laughed at him. Are you joking me? Don't you realize this is Ukraine? Communism? It's awful. That you can't find anything anywhere. And his main interest, he wrote another book, Professor Rossman, he writes another book called The Lord's Jews, Jews and Magnates in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. He writes this amazing, amazing book. And he's researching for this book, and he only really cares about Jewish and Polish relations, mainly all about how did the magnates, how did the nobles really get along with the Jews that were underneath their dominion. So as he's searching in this archive, what does he find? He finds from a certain family, we're going to discuss this in a little bit, he finds an actual file that contains the records, the tax records, between 1700 and 1800 in Mezhebez. Now that is a huge deal. And the way that he describes the introduction, he says, I had a huge Yetzer Hara. I mean, I wish these were my Yetzer Haras. He said, I have a huge Yetzer Hara. That what do I want to do? I want to go ahead and delve into the subject. Did the Baal Shem Tov even exist? Was he even around? Was he a real person? So he says, I'm going to hold off on this. And according, this is what he writes in the introduction, he says for a few weeks he was able to hold that Yitzhara at bay, and he was able to go ahead and, you know, learn as much as he could all about the Polish and about the magnates and the nobles and the Jews. However, after a few weeks, he just can't take it anymore. So what does he do? He goes ahead and he opens it. And what does he find? And this is something absolutely incredible. If you take a look at page 3, we will be looking at this in a little bit soon, but you will find, if you take a look at the not bolded part, I guess the whiter part, what it says over there, it says, Balsam Doctor. Balsam Doctor and the word Lieber. As you can see in the bottom, the translation is Dr. Baal Shem Tov, exempt. And as we're going to see tonight, this is a major, major, major issue. It's going to create a lot of paradigm shifts when it comes to thinking about Hasidus and the origins of Hasidus. Oh, you'll see. This is incredible. It gets even better. I know I have friends that are Balsams, and like they come from the Baal Shem Tov. It's amazing. It's very, very cool. So, yeah. So, Rav Yisrael Ben Eliezer was born in 1700. He was born in 1700. The problem that Moshe Rossman shows is that none of the documentation from his time you could actually believe. Why? Because the main text about the Besht was written 75 years after he lived. So anytime you're talking about any sort of text that is so long after the subject has passed away, you're going to discuss all sorts of very interesting, what are the authors going to go ahead and add, what things are true, what things are not true. According to the Shibchei HaBesht, now let me also preface this, this picture that we have over here, this is not the Baal Shem Tov. This is the picture that's classically known as the Baal Shem Tov, but if you see in the bottom, it's actually Rabbi Shmuel Falk, who was known to be the Baal Shem of London. He was known to be the Baal Shem of London. This we know 100%. This picture is not the Baal Shem Tov, even though you will most certainly find it very, very often. I mean, I've seen Gedolim posters of big rabbis, and you'll see this picture right underneath it, Baal Shem Tov. That is not the Baal Shem Tov, we actually do not have any pictures of him. So according to Shimchei Abesh, what happened was that the Baal Shem Tov was born to a father that was 100 years old. What happened was his father and his mother, they were unable. I know, it's even worse than Charlie Chaplin. Charlie Chaplin had a kid at 83, which is like the oldest I've ever heard about. But whatever, I don't know, maybe you guys know better, I don't know. But basically, Avraham Avinu, yeah. Thank you, that's awesome. Thank you so much. So what happens is that according to Shimchei Abesh, the reason why the Baal Shem Tov's father and mother were able to have him was that there was a huge fight going on at the time between the Ottoman Turks and between Poland. And Podolia, if you take a look at the very first page, the bottom of the page where it says Podolia, you'll see the only thing that has a box around it is Mezhebezh. And you will see Podolia, this area, is switched back and forth a few times. And what happened was it was actually conquered by the Ottoman Turks. And the story goes is that the Baal Shem Tov's father was captured. And while he was captured, there was a gorgeous woman, I assume younger, a gorgeous woman that goes ahead and wants to, you know, sin with him. And what does he do? He's actually able to go ahead and withstand that test. So he gets a dream that you're going to go ahead and have a kid who's going to end up saving Klal Yisrael. You're going to end up having a kid that's going to end up saving everybody. And that's a very, very big deal. His parents passed away when he was very young, and he was cared for by the community. He was given a very normal, very, very normal upbringing in terms of nothing so crazy. However, the one thing that really distinguishes him in the cheder versus other people was his opportunities that he used to take to go off and really do something called hispodidus, to really go into the woods and be alone and pour out his soul to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Most people when they're in cheder, even back then, they're not necessarily so spiritually inclined. But Yisrael, the Baal Shem, he was absolutely into this. He was absolutely amazing. And what he used to do at this time is that he actually used to do all sorts of, I don't know, crazy stuff, like for example, self-flagellation. For example, he used to dip himself into a freezing cold mikvah. For example, he used to roll himself in the snow. As we're going to see, these were things that were indicative of a Hasidic life before the Baal Shem Tov. We're going to actually discuss this, you know, quite a lot. This is going to be very, very important. And he would do these self-punishing rites on himself in order to get closer to Hashem. Now, all these things all have mikorot, they all have sources. Most of them are not for everybody in terms of these are only for people who are tremendously special or who you know want to take upon themselves these certain types of rites and everything. The Baal Shem, at a very early age, according to the Shimchei Abesh, took upon himself these types of things. So once his education ended, he became a teacher's assistant, and the story in Shimchei Abesh is very similar to the Pied Piper. He would walk around singing Shirov Tishbachot, all sorts of amazing things, so Kadosh Baruch Hu, all the kids would be singing also. He was amazing at that job. Later on, he served as a shamash. As I'm sure you're starting to notice over here, nothing about being a great rabbi, nothing about being any sort of honorable position, nothing about that. We're talking about a melamed, and not even a regular melamed, not even a teacher, but being a teacher's assistant. And now we're saying being a shamash, being the beadle of the synagogue. No, not beadle, like, you know, bring it up, whatever, let it go, oh, whatever. But, you know, becoming the beadle of the synagogue, in terms of that's not something that's tremendously respectful. That's not a very, very, very big deal. But yet, he was able to go ahead and privately learn Kabbalah. And he was privately able to learn Torah by himself, completely unperturbed, completely away from everybody else. And he was he had a tremendous amount of haslacha. At this time, and this is extremely, extremely, extremely controversial. Extremely controversial. I don't even think I brought it. There was somebody, There was somebody named Adam Baal Shem. Adam Baal Shem. Adam Baal Shem, according to the Shimchei Abesh, was one of the teachers of the Baal Shem Tov. There is a bit of a machloket if he ever met Adam Baal Shem. It might be that his writings were bequeathed to the Baal Shem Tov, but nevertheless, these writings were very Kabbalistic, very, very holy. However, this is all according to Shimchei Abesh. However, according to Gershom Shalom, Gershom Shalom writes in his book, Mystical Trends, he says, who was Adam Baal Shem? What were these writings? He actually ends up saying that they're really writings that originate with a person named Herschel Tzoraf. Herschel Tzoraf, which I don't know if this is for any of you Sabbatean scholars, he was one of the very big Sabbatean prophets. So according to Gershom Shalom, what he says that a lot of these Kabbalistic ideas that filtered down to the Besht really originate with Shabtai Tzvi. Now, that I do want to just preface this by saying, I said this last year, but I'll say the same joke again. But there's a Yiddishism, which I'm not very good at because I'm Sephardi, but there's a Yiddishism that says that to a worm in horseradish, the world is horseradish. I don't know if you ever heard that before. I didn't even hear it from a Jewish person. I heard it from Malcolm Gladwell one time on TV. I heard from Malcolm Gladwell, to a worm in horseradish, the world is horseradish. So I do want to just say, before talking about Gershom Shalom, which we're going to talk about later, to everything is Sabbateanism. I just want to make that very clear. Reform is Sabbateanism. Zionism is Sabbateanism. Obviously Hasidus is Sabbateanism. Everything is Sabbateanism. So I just want to just let you know, take that with a, you know, to continue with the Yiddish, take it with a shtickle, a bissel of salt, take it with a little bit. Thank you so much. See, I'm not good at the Ashkenazi stuff, but I try. You know, I try melding it together. It's my wife's influence. She's working on me. So what happens is that also during this time, he has a first wife. This wife unfortunately passes away. And he ends up meeting a great person named Rav Ephraim of Brody. And Rav Ephraim of Brody, he senses there's something very special about the Baal Shem Tov. Keep in mind, this is all in Shibchei Habesh. When was Shibchei Habesh published? 1815. When did the Baal Shem Tov pass away? 1760. 1760. He lived between 1700 and 1760. So Shibchei Habesh, 1815. So according to Shibchei Habesh, he meets Rav Ephraim of Brody, and he says, it was back in the day, you are going to marry my daughter. And what happens is that they drop the contract, he's going to marry the daughter, and unfortunately what happens, Rav Ephraim passes away, and the Baal Shem, now keep in mind, looks like a normal dude, he's a shamash, he's a former beetle, and what's he do? I mean, he has a beetle. And what does he do? He comes over and presents himself to this rabbinic family. His brother-in-law, his soon-to-be brother-in-law, Rav Gershom Kitover. Oh man, he is not happy at all. He says, who is this guy? He's coming here not wearing rabbinic clothing. He's coming here, he's not talking Torah. He doesn't seem to be a particularly big Tamid Chacham. Why is he marrying into his family? Why is he marrying my sister? I'm against it. This is awful. Just to tell you a small story, this is not related to Hasidus, but it's just an interesting story, just to know. The Chazon Ish, he had a sister. The Chazon Ish's own marriage was problematic. We actually spoke about this last year. If you take a look, there's an amazing book by Benny Brown all about it. It's about 1,000 pages. It's an awesome, awesome book. I love it, all in Hebrew. Published by YU and Bar Ilan. But he read a book by a great rabbi named the Stipler. His name was Yisrael Yaakov Kanievsky. And he reads this amazing, amazing book, and he says, I want this guy to be my brother-in-law. I want this guy. So he sends a letter, and what happens is, and he sends train fare, and he ends up, the Stipler, which is what we're going to call him, the Stipler ends up coming to Vilna to go meet the Chazon Ish and go meet the Chazon Ish's sister. So when he gets onto the train, what does he see? He sees that the seats, it's a possibility that they're shatniks. Maybe it's wool and linen together, which according to the Torah, a person is not allowed to really wear together. He was being machmir, he was being stringent. In reality, you are actually able to sit on it as long as it doesn't rise up on top of you. But he ends up, it's like something like a 36-hour trip. He ends up not sleeping. He ends up not sitting down the entire time. So when he comes over to the Chazon Ish starts peppering him with questions. And he's like, And he's like asking him questions. And he's like, this is the guy that I saw in the Sefer? Like, what? So he tells him, he's like, finally, he's like, can I please see a bed? And he's like, yeah, absolutely. And then he takes a nap, and then he talks to him later, and he's like, perfect, you're going to marry my sister, and that's exactly what happened. So it's not the exact same thing here, but you have his brother-in-law, he's so disappointed. He says, I thought my father had, I thought he's very, very good at reading people. And look at this dude, he's a nobody, he's nothing. However, his wife knew the truth. His wife, I guess, women always could perceive things a lot better. I certainly hope so. So basically, what does she do? She decides, her and her husband, the Baal Shem, they decide to go to the Carpathian Mountains, and according to Shibchei Habesh, he used to spend Shabbos to Shabbos completely by himself in the mountains, learning Kabbalah, learning with all sorts of, Magidim, all sorts of heavenly angels and, you know, former people. To give a small idea, if you guys remember when we spoke about the Ben Ish Chai, I'm sure we all remember the Ben Ish Chai from, 2 months ago, but we said that the Ben Ish Chai was very, very mystical, and he said that he actually had a chavrusa with someone named Achashiloni. Achashiloni was part of David HaMelech's Beis Din. So you're talking about a very, very, very old guy. So obviously this is mystical. I will tell you, Achashiloni must be an amazing, amazing chavrusa, because he also learned with the Baal Shem, according to Shibchei HaBesh. Tremendous, tremendous person. We actually even spoke about him when we spoke last about the Rambam, because we were saying some people want to pigeonhole the Rambam into being someone who's tremendously rational, and the Ravid as someone who's more mystical. We quoted the introduction to the Rambam, where the Rambam says, Achashiloni lived 400 years. Does that sound mystical to you? Oh, it most certainly does. The Rambam, the rationalist par excellence, says the Achashiloni lived 400 years, and the Ravid writes, no, it was a different Achashiloni. That's what we spoke about. I'm sure you guys are holding all of my previous shirim as well as I am. Okay, all right. So what happened was, is that they're in the Carpathian Mountains, and finally he gets some sort of nevuah, some sort of message from Hashem at the age of 36. You must reveal yourself to be who you are. You must go out and let people know who you are. I also want to mention, also during this time, with Adam Baal Shem, either his writings or with him, he's constantly meeting, according to Shibchei HaBesh, he's constantly meeting with other great tzaddikim. We know, for example, that there's 36 great tzaddikim that live in the world. According to this, according to Shibchei HaBesh, they're all Ashkenazi, because there's usually 36 people hanging out in Poland, whatever. I remember when I read it, I'm like, what? There's no Sephardim? I don't get it. Racist. Open up. Come on, at least Brown versus Board of Education. Come on, let him in. So basically, he's able to come out. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So in 1736, he's actually comes out as the Baal Shem, and he's called the Baal Shem Tov. A lot of people mistake. This is something that Moshe Rosman brings down amazing. A lot of people want to say, what does Baal Shem Tov mean? That it means a person of excellent, people love him. People know his name very well. A person of, master of good reputation. Very similar to like it says in Pirkei Avot. It says in Pirkei Avot, who is amazing? Someone who's a Keter Shem Tov. That's the best out of everything. Someone who has a great name. Rabbi Nadav, he's the Keter Shem Tov this year at the dinner. I don't know if you... Yeah, come to the dinner. So what happens is... I know, I'm not even paid by the shul. But what happens is that the Baal Shem, that actually ends up being a little bit inaccurate. Because Tov is not really essential. Even the Besh, we have 6 letters from the Besh, and in a couple of these letters, he actually refers to himself as Beis Shin, and he leaves off the Tuf. He's called a Baal Shem, and this is a big deal. What exactly is a Baal Shem? So Baal Shem is very, very similar, very, very similar to something that's found in Mongol writing, something that's found more in the Far East. It's called a shaman. A shaman is this type of mystical person who's able to bridge worlds, who's able to, go ahead and talk to people in the next world and be part of this world and do something called kfitzat haderech, which means going to places very, very quickly and being able to see the future and being able to do all sorts of crazy things. That's what it is in Near Eastern literature. A Baal Shem ends up being basically the exact same thing. It ends up being the exact same thing. And in fact, but being a Baal Shem, and this is a big issue, because what happens is, I'm actually going to do something a little bit out of order, I hope it's okay. The Baal Shem ends up going to Mezhebesh. And this is also in Shibchei HaBesh, because it's very important to realize what exactly is going on over here. He comes, and there's big Talmidei Chachamim, there's big rabbis that are living in Mezhebesh. And what happens is that they hear that this person's coming, the Baal Shem Tov, and they're against it. What are you, a Baal Shem? You deal with practical Kabbalah. What do we care about? Gemara, Rashi, Tosfos, that's what we care about. We don't care so much about what sort of miracles you're able to do. That's all not part of this world. We care more about this world. So what happens is that the Baal Shem talks with them and they're very unimpressed. He had this way with people, that they were very unimpressed. And what happened was that these 2 Talmidei Chachamim, they go to bed that night, and each one of them has the exact same dream. They both go up to Shemayim, And what happens is the Baal Shem, this is all in Shibchei Hevesh, the Baal Shem is going ahead and giving all sorts of kashyas, all sorts of very heavy-duty Gemara questions. Very, very hard questions. And all of these great scholars in heaven, I don't even know who these people are, probably huge, huge people, they have no idea to answer these questions. And what does the Baal Shem do? The Baal Shem is able to answer every single one of those questions in this dream. They later on come to Baal Shem Tov and they realize, they say, whoa, that wasn't just a dream, that's reality. That the Baal Shem really is a tremendous Talmudist, and both of them become big Hasidim of the Baal Shem. As you see, you have to get some sort of Talmudic. You have to get some sort of, I'll use the term Nigla. Nigla means revealed, the revealed Torah. You need that type of cred before you become a huge mystical person. So, there's a big misnomer. The big misnomer is that being a Baal Shem is negative. You see it in the book, once again, published 1815. Oh, he's just a Baal Shem. He's not so great. You know, he's just does practical, you know, just does practical Kabbalah. Just does practical mysticism. That's not such a big deal. We care more about Torah, about the revealed Torah. That actually ends up being very, very inaccurate. Because if you take a look at history, which I love doing, and Rosman does this incredibly, he shows that even the biggest rabbinic families, they consulted Baal Shem. For example, the very famous Katzenelnbogen family, which we spoke about when we spoke about 2 years ago, when we spoke all about the Ramchal, when we spoke all about the Sforno, we spoke about the Maharami Pano, that we said the Katzenelnbogen family, a very, very big rabbinic family, each one of them consulted a Baal Shem. They are like the Gedolei Ador. They are these big, big rabbis. If it's something embarrassing to go to Baal Shem, why are these very normal, very accepted rabbis going ahead and visiting a Baal Shem? Not only that, in the generation, during the Baal Shem Tov, he actually ends up passing, I think, 1755, Rav Yonasan Eibishitz, I'm sure we learned about this before, we've done a lot of this stuff, but what happens is, Rav Yonasan Eibishitz, according to Rav Schechter, was the Moshe Rabbeinu of his generation. He was the biggest rabbi, the head of a huge yeshiva. He was in Altona and Hamburg. Huge, 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 huge rabbi. Huge. Now, he was accused by Rav Yaakov Emden as being a crypto-Sabbatean. Because keep in mind, Shabtai Tzvi passed away, I believe 1683. Someone could probably check this up on Google. Either 1683 or 1689. I don't remember exactly which. He ends up we're talking right now, 1755. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who's the son of the Chacham Tzvi, this great, great rabbi, formerly of Amsterdam, he ends up saying, hey, you, Rabbi Yonasan Eibishitz, the biggest rabbi in the entire world, you are a Sabbatean. And how do I know it? Because I could see your kameyas, I could see your amulets, and what are you relying on? You're relying on Kabbalistic functions and all sorts of all sorts of Sabbatean names, and that's how we know that you're actually really a Sabbatean. And it created a huge fight. At one point, almost every single major rabbi was in Cheirem at this time, which is a huge, huge deal, which is probably how it is nowadays, but whatever. So what happens is that during this time, Rav Yonasan Eibishitz was known as a great, great rabbi. In fact, Rav Shach said about him, Rav Shach, who we spoke about Rav Ovadia, Rav Shach says something amazing. He says, some people, they learn Musar Sfarim. They go ahead and they want to learn books of ethics in order to learn better, in order to be better. He says, you know what my Musar book is? It's a sefer called the Urim V'Tumim. It's a book on Shulchan Aruch by Rav Yonasan Eibishitz. He says, when I see the greatness of Rav Yonasan in those books, I say, whoa, I better work harder. I better work a lot, lot harder. That's what he says. For most people, they're not really. I could say, I'm most certainly not like that in the slightest. So during his time, Rav Yonasan, what was the reason why he was giving out amulets? Because he was the predominant Baal Shem. He also was the biggest rabbi of his generation. If being a Baal Shem was so bad, therefore, what are you talking about? The Gadol Ador is the Baal Shem. This is stuff that Rosman brings down. It's really, really incredible. And it does make a lot of sense. So the Baal Shem, I also want to mention, this is interesting because I don't know how much we've spoken about Sabbateanism. There's a huge, amongst Orthodox Jews, there's not really a question. Like there was just a Haggadah that was published by a person named Rabbi Shalom Hammer. And in the introduction, there's an introduction by Rabbi Beryl Wine. And in the introduction, he writes, he says, only amongst academic scholars is there a question that if Jonas and Ivishitz was a Sabbatean or not. Only amongst academic scholars. Now, I found that very funny because, like, it's definitely not put to rest in the slightest. And within academic circles, it's by and large a given that Rav Yonasan Ivishitz, even though he was this huge, huge gaon and gadol and incredible, according, and now I'm scared to say it's a recorder, whatever, please God, but basically according to most scholarship, he was a Sabbatean, at least a crypto-Sabbatean. Now, you have to realize there are different gradations of Sabbateanism in terms of there are those people that were awful people that did all sorts of antinomian stuff like wife swapping and eating all sorts of disgusting chaylev. They used to make a bracha, Baruch atah Hashem, matir asurim. Hashem, you are allowing what was previously usur because they believed Shabtai Tzvi came, he brought the Messianic era, therefore we don't have to keep the Torah anymore. We don't have to do this anymore. Tisha B'Av, it was a big holiday. I hate to tell you what happened in Australia last year during Tisha B'Av. So what happens is, it's a huge, 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 and there's a huge discussion about this, all about whether or not it was a Sabbatean. The way that I like to explain it to people that ask me, which, you know, you guys are my captive audience right now, is that there's different gradations. You had certain people that were extreme, extreme Sabbateans. You had those people that were like, well, Shabbat Tzvi, he could be Mashiach. I mean, why not? Maybe he'll come back. There even existed a whole group called the Dun Meh, all the way up until World War I, even World War II, a lot of them were killed by the Nazis in Salonika, that they actually believed. They went out every single year on the Yuriset of Shabtai Tzvi, they went over to the ocean, and they saw all sorts of prayers and everything that Shabtai Tzvi should come back. That's all the way into the 20th century. It is quite incredible. So, what we're seeing over here is that being a Baal Shem is not necessarily negative. Not to mention the very person on your board, he's a Baal Shem of London, also very, very famous in London. Now, what was the main function of a Baal Shem? This is before modern medicine. The normal thing a Baal Shem did is that helped you with any sort of ailments that you had, whether it was spiritual ailments or whether or not it was physical ailments. That's why, for example, the Kesen Elenbogen family, one of the major things that they were asking a certain Baal Shem about is that they wanted to know, how is it better, how would you make it easier for a woman to give birth? Because obviously we're talking about a time where it was very, very difficult, and he's given back all these instructions about tying a kameya, tying an amulet around the woman's belly, but it can't be on there too early, and it can't be on there too late, because if it's on there too late, then maybe her intestines will fall out. It actually does say this. It's crazy stuff. But the point is that even you had this family who were big, big scholars, they were also turning to the Baal Shem. They were also turning to these people, to these doctors. What happens is, the Bezh later on moved to western Ukraine, to Podolia, a town called Mezhebezh. And according to Shimchei HaBezh, 10,000 people came with him. The problem is, according to records that we have from back then, there weren't even 10,000 people in all of Podolia. I mean, obviously, anytime you're talking about a book that's written in 1815, you know, you're going to discuss all sorts of, you know, all sorts of things that are added in and stuff. So, tons of people came with him to Mezhebezh, and what happens is that he ends up making a very, very, you know, he's awesome, and people are coming to him. People know that he's a very, very good doctor, as you guys notice from the. As you guys notice from the tax return, that he's most certainly called Balsam Doctor. He's called Doctor, and he's called Doctor from the Polish government. That's on page 3. So, Mezhebezh was a town of Talmidei Chachamim, and like we mentioned, two scholars came to test the Baal Shem, and they came away with their dream, and they were so happy, because the Baal Shem was such an amazing, amazing person. And what happens is that you see over here is that you need to not only be a master of mysticism, but also a master of Talmud to be accepted by everybody. And he has an amazing... Wait, one second, sorry. Oh, yeah. So he's very, very powerful. Yeah, okay. I'll give you another example of this. So he's able to go into Shemayim. I'm sorry, I should have mentioned this before. He goes to Shemayim, he's able to answer all these questions in Shemayim. But here in this world, he doesn't answer any of those questions. Here in this world, he's a very normal person. Obviously, if someone asked him for it, he would, in theory, be able to give it over. But, you know, here in this world, his job is really to connect with the local folk. I wanted to say there's also a story about the Chidushei Arim, which I found to be very, very similar. Chidushei Arim was the grandfather of the Sfas Emes. And there's a story that's told that he was a great Talmudist, and he was. an amazing Talmudist. His first MS wrote an amazing commentary on the Talmud, which is not mystical at all. In terms of it's very, very neglect, and it's an amazing, amazing parish. I love it. And what happened was his grandfather, Chiddush HaRim, decides one time, I'm going to answer all of the world's hard kashyas on Shas. Any sort of problem anyone has, any shagas aryeh, any sort of issue that you're having in any sefer or anything, I'm going to write the answer to it. And what happened was is that he writes this entire sefer, and what happens is that there's a big fire, and he loses that book. Oh, no, that's not what happens. My fault, I'm sorry, that's another story. What happens is that he gets a dream from Shemayim that says, you have to get rid of that sefer, stick it in the oven. You know why? Because if you publish this sefer, what's going to happen is Torah learning is going to end. Because you're going to be able to answer all of the questions. As you see, this is not a very Lithuanian idea. If you're from Lita, halavai, you want to publish that sefer that answers all the questions. That would be amazing. But according to Hasidus, according to Chiddush HaRim, he said you cannot do it, obviously based on mystical considerations, like a heavenly voice. So his fame spread far and wide, and he was very much influenced by the writings of the Arizal. The Arizal was Rav Yitzchak Luria, originally from Egypt, and later on he ends up coming to Tzfat. Great, great rabbi, passes away at the age of 36. Or 42, I don't remember. Great, great, great rabbi, huge. He has a big, big Talmud, Rav Chaim Vital, who ends up writing up all of his stuff. It's a sefer called the Eitz Chaim. Very, very big deal. The Arizal comes up with a lot of very interesting ideas, which are based on previous sources, but he popularized them. For example, if you guys remember from Rav Kook 2 weeks ago, Rav Kook talks about going around and lifting up sparks all over. It means that even in base things, even in disgusting things, there are sparks of Kiddusha, there are sparks of holiness. We said a very extreme case that Rav Kook writes that even in Christianity and even in Sabbateanism, there is a kernel of holiness that has to be freed. Like I mentioned last time, I don't know what that means. But the Baal Shem Tov, but the Arizal, writes a lot about these different things, about raising sparks all around the world. And this is a big deal, and it has a huge influence on tons of people. And it becomes very, very, very popular, and therefore you're having people that were normally regular Talmudists, but in their own Bate Midrasha, they go ahead and they put away the Gemara, and they start learning Kabbalah, they start learning this mysticism. As we mentioned, what does he do? He also makes this language of the Zohar very accessible. He makes it somewhat easier for people to understand, and therefore it gains a very, very wide reputation. What the Baal Shem does, and this is a big, big deal, and this is according to some scholars, which we're going to see in a little bit, but he makes these Kabbalistic terms, these mystical terms, very, very common. He even makes it even easier than the Arizal. The Arizal still dealt with things that the Baal Shem did when he was young. Like we mentioned before, he used to whip himself, he used to roll himself in the snow, he used to go in the mikveh in the ice cold. But the Baal Shem, he comes out and he says, you don't need to do that anymore. That is not what Hashem wants. Hashem does not want that anymore. And that became a huge deal. Because previously, if you wanted to be what's called a chassid, if you wanted to be a pious person, you had to go ahead and do all those types of things. Like, I don't know, like in Angels and Demons, like, or Da Vinci Code, there's like a certain character that's like constantly, you know, whipping himself and doing stuff like that. From the book, not the movie. I didn't see the movie. So, what happens is that he says you could divorce these types of rites, these types of very painful, hard things to do, but still be Kabbalistically inclined and still co-opt and become a chassid. The big cases, and we spoke about this also before, is that there are certain things that just become holy. So for example, you could be doing something extremely mundane, but yet it becomes tremendously holy. Like we spoke about a shoemaker, for example, who the story goes is that every single stitch he does is with more hislavus, is with more, you know, love for Hashem than even someone sitting in the Beit Midrash and learning. Another example would be, this is the most famous story of the Baal Shem, of the shepherd that comes in, and the Baal Shem is davening, and he's praying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the shepherd comes in, and he doesn't know anything. He's unlettered. He doesn't know how to even read Hebrew. The only thing he has is a whistle. So what does he do? He blows his whistle. And everyone gets so upset. What are you doing blowing this whistle in here? How dare you? The Baal Shem turns around. He says, no way. He says, that whistle, with that hitlav, with that love for Hashem that this shepherd has, that broke through the barrier in Shemayim, and it went straight up to heaven. And that's what's really allowing all of our tefillah. So what you see is that if you would go into a Lithuanian shul, and you have a person walk in there with a flute, and a person going ahead and blowing it, you know what you would say? Get out. Leave this shul right now. Like, what are you doing? That's not right for the decorum. What you're starting to see is that you're starting to see that even very mundane things, like blowing this whistle, gain a tremendous amount of holiness, gain a lot of kiddushah. He wasn't necessarily preaching anything new, but what he was doing is that he was emphasizing joy. Obviously, you don't have to go ahead and do all this crazy stuff. Joy, prayer, love, and more. The Besh never really wrote anything down. All of his teachings really come from a few different sources. One of them is from the Toldot Yaakov Yosef, by Rav Yaakov Yosef of Polonia. I don't know if anyone could correct me with that last word. I apologize. Once again, I'm not so good at the names of the European towns. He writes a lot of the stuff that we have about the Baal Shem. Without him, we really don't really have anything for the Baal Shem. We have a few letters. For example, one letter is to his brother-in-law living in Israel. There's a few. It's called Savat Hariv. There's another thing called Savat Harivash. There's a lot of very interesting things, but like nothing that's a huge deal. Toldot Yaakov Yosef is a huge. I mean, it's 5 volumes, all about the Baal Shem, with stories about the Baal Shem. I heard the Baal Shem say this. The Baal Shem himself never wrote anything down, really. We do have one tshuva of his that Professor Rosman makes a very, very big deal about. In this class, we're not going to make a big deal about it, because personally, I'm not so convinced, but whatever. That's just my own feeling. He had a great, great love of Israel. He had a great, great love of Israel. And he wanted to go so many times. He went as far as Constantinople, and he wanted to go, but he was never able to. And he saw from Shemayim, he saw that all of this stuff is ordained from Hashem that he wasn't supposed to go. So for example, he said, if I were able to go to Israel, and I were able to get a meeting with Or HaChaim, with Rav Chaim Ben Attar, who lived in Yerushalayim, if I would go ahead and meet him, the second we would meet, Mashiach would come. In fact, they tell a story, that one time, there's actually 3 versions of this in Shibchei HaBesh, that he's sitting at his table, and what does he do? In the middle of everything, you know, everyone's talking, everyone's doing everything, what does he do? He tears Kriya. He tears Kriya. And his students, they said, why do you just tear Kriya? He said, you know why? The Or HaChaim, Rav Chaim Ben Attar, he passed away. He passed away. So, the Baal Shem Tov's cousin was married to the Notabi Yehuda. Huda was Chesca Landau. We spoke about him a few weeks ago with Rabbi Goldberg, an amazing, amazing shiur. The Notabi Huda was actually anti-Hasidus, even though his wife was cousins with the Baal Shem. And what happened was that when he heard this story, he said, "Is it awesome? It's terrible. You can't do that. You could only tear Kriya if you're actually by the mace, by the person, when they're actually passing away. And therefore, what he actually did, he just did Baal Tashlis. That means destroying something for no reason. Because why is he going out and cutting his shirt? He's not there." So the answer that the Baal Shem gave to him, he said, "No, I was there." Nah. That's like a very, very Hasidic story. I mean, it's beautiful. I love it. There's a lot of stories. I'll tell you another amazing story also. I love this story. There's a whole bunch of stories between Notabi Yehuda and between the Baal Shem. We're basically like the same idea. What happened was is that one time they're both talking Torah together, and a woman comes in to Notabi Yehuda and says, "I have a chicken for you to go see whether or not the chicken's kosher or not." So Notabi Yehuda's looking at the chicken, he's opening up Sfarim, going back and forth, looking at stuff, looking at every single sefer he could look at that would possibly permit it. And he ends up saying, "I'm sorry, lady, it's not good. I'm so sorry, it's awful." And he actually ends up giving her money, like, to go buy another chicken, which is very nice. But what happens is that when the woman leaves, the Baal Shem says, "I don't get it. Couldn't you just see from the tum'ah? Couldn't you just see from the impurity on the chicken that the chicken's not kosher?" So Levi Huda, supposedly, as the story goes, says, "Nah, what are you talking about? You can't paskin halacha that way." So you can see, like, this type of tension, this halachas tension versus this mystical tension going on over here. So we have a letter from the Baal Shem Tov in 1746 to his brother-in-law, which describes in very, very personal terms his Aliyah to Shamayim. He actually writes that on, I believe it was Rosh Hashanah, what happened was, he was the Chazan, he's leading the services, and in the middle of the prayers, he puts his head down, and he actually describes this himself, that his neshama went up to Shamayim, and went to something called the Palace of the Messiah. Palace of the Messiah. Another example of the Baal Shem Tov, of showing you what his orientation very much is. I'm sorry I wasn't able to put any of this in the handout. But it's brought down in Savat HaRivash. Let's say what happens is you're walking on the street and you see a particularly attractive girl. What's a person supposed to do for that? So if you're just thinking in a normative way, you'd say, whoa, like, don't think about that. The Baal Shem said what you should do is that you should take that image and realize, what does that come from? That beauty comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore go ahead and move that into Kiddusha. Move it into holiness. It's a very, now obviously he's not saying go and like look at, you know, Victoria's Secret catalog. He's not saying that. But like what he's saying is that if that happens to happen, you know, that's how you should view it. And it's a very beautiful way. It's a very, very beautiful way of looking at life. Definitely. So the Baal Shem passed away in 1760, and the leadership went to the Maggid of Mezerich, Rav Dov Baer, a former ascetic who came to the Baal Shem and was completely bowled away. Along with the Toldos Yaakov Yosef, they both formed the second generation of Hasidus. The third generation is really where Hasidus really, you know, spread his wings. That's really when Hasidus became very important. That's where you have Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the Baal Tanya. It's where you have the Noam Elimelech, the Noam Elimelech. You have Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk. You have Rav Shmelke of Nicholsburg. And you even have Rav Pinchas Horowitz. You have the Baal Hafla. Now he's interesting because he was a Talmud of the Maggid of Mezerich, but he was also co-teachers of the Chatam Sofer, of the Chasam Sofer, along with another great rabbi, Nassim Adler. And he was about as Talmudic as you could get. But yet he absolutely loved. His brother was actually Rav Shmelke. His brother was Rav Shmelke of Nicholsburg. He ends up becoming Hasidus Rebbe. But Rav Pinchas Horowitz is someone who's very much part. His Sfarim are learned all the time. His Sefer, the Hafla, and forget, Sefer HaMakna on Kiddushin. They are basic books on Kiddushin and nothing to do at all with any sort of writings of Hasidus. However, his son was a big, big misnaget. Misnaget means that they were very against Hasidus, and he was actually in charge of editing his father's books. So what happens is that he wrote other Sfarim, and what does he do? He takes every single reference to the Maggid of Mezerich, and what does he do? He wipes it out. He uses white out, and he takes it out, because he's very, very anti-Hasidish. What's funny, though, is that he goes ahead, and he takes out also the Maggid Mishnah, who's like a normal parish on the Rambam. I guess it's a rabbi joke. But basically, it's hilarious because he ends up taking a very normative rabbi along with the... Yeah, okay. All right. So let's move on. All right. So Hasidus spread extremely quickly in his generation and enveloped all of Eastern Europe except for Lithuania. And even Lithuania, it did penetrate thanks to Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi. Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the Baal Tanya, was not into any of these sort of miracle things, and he stressed tremendously Limud HaTorah. He was a tremendous Talmid Chacham. He wrote the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, which is learned every single day. His Psakim, his laws are found even in the Mishnah Berurah. Very, very, very normative. His Sefer, the Tanya, is an amazing, amazing Sefer. I learn it. I'm a huge, huge fan. I'll even tell you, Rav Schechter, he told an amazing story. I don't want to say the professor, because I'm sure a lot of you guys might know him. But Rav Herschel Schechter, Rosh Yeshiva of YU, he was in a certain class in YU that he felt was kifira, that he felt was, what would be a good word for kifira? What, heresy. He thought it was heresy. So the halakha is that if you hear heresy, you should get up, tear kriya, and walk out of the room, which is actually exactly what Rav Schechter does later on in the year. But before then, he's trying to deal with it with a certain professor. His professor was not Orthodox. And he's talking all about different things. I mean, Rav Schechter told me, I don't want to repeat it out loud. But basically, what happens is, Rav Schechter told me that every single night when he went back to his dorm, he used to learn the Sefer, he used to learn the Tanya. Because by learning the Tanya, it has so much Kiddusha, it has so much holiness, he felt like would be able to help his spiritual, you know, reserves in order to go ahead and, you know, and deal with this particular class. It actually ended up being that Rav Schechter did not get his degree when he became Rosh Yeshiva. It was actually later because he actually walked out of this class. It's a great story. It's like a very big deal. during this time, this is really where you start having the beginning of misnagdim, of people that are against Chassidus. This is something we spoke about a lot when we spoke about Rav Kook. Rav Kook comes from both. He comes from regular Volozhin, from his father, and he comes from Lubavitch, from Chabad, Chassidus, from his mother. And we spoke about how that was a very, very big deal, because it means that Rav Kook was able to meld both the mystical and meld, you know, things that are, I don't know, ephemeral with things that are physical. So we've spoken about the personage of the Besht, but what caused his movement to move around so rapidly? Oh, this is a letter of the Besht to his brother-in-law in 1746. We have it. It's amazing. I highly suggest it. Oh, we didn't even get to talk about him yet. Oh my, there's a lot to talk about. Oh wow. Okay. So when we think about Poland nowadays, and I don't know about you, but I don't know, there's so many jokes about, you know, Poland and stuff like that. So like, we usually think of this backwater place, disgusting, awful, terrible, not a great place to be. However, during this time, during the 1600s, and even during the 1500s, it was actually known to be one of the big centers of scholarship, one of the big centers of culture. In fact, when I was in YU, I was in a class with, his name is Danny Krasna, he's actually from the community. I'm sure you guys, I'm sure some of you guys know him. So we were both in a class together in YU. We had a certain professor named Professor Merrick, and he was not Jewish, he was from Poland, but his main job, he was supposed to be teaching Renaissance history, but it was basically all about Polish history the entire time, because he was Polish. He was trying to show us that Poland, under Bonaswarca and all sorts of other different personages, that they were really at the forefront of Renaissance, and that they were very cultured. And it turns out, he's right, 100%. Poland was a great place to be. And in fact, Jews moved there, and very much like Egypt was, the breadbasket of the Middle East, Poland was the breadbasket of Eastern Europe. And tons of people are moving there. The way that things worked in Poland, Jews were very, very, very important. Very important. The central government of Poland was not very, very strong. It was very decentralized. It was mainly controlled by a whole bunch of different magnates. They did have a sort of, I don't know, it's called the Sven, I think. The Sen. No, the Sen. S-E-J-N. It's a type of parliament that they had. It was democratic to a certain degree, but everything was basically controlled by these magnates. And they owned huge, huge, huge swaths of land. They owned a ton. And what was one of the main things that they made? I mean, you could go back to Polish jokes now. They made liquor. Alcohol was a very, very big deal. And who are you going to go ahead and have managing the alcohol? You're going to have Jews. Jews, in general, they're not drunkards, in general. I mean, unfortunately, it's getting worse nowadays. I mean, there's the whole... Dr. David Pelkovitz from YU, he says that we're the only... The reason why our rates of depression are so high, because we're the only people that don't self-medicate. That's what he wrote. Bada-bing. All right. So what happens is... I'm here every Friday. So what happens is that it's not a mistake that the Shah, Rav Shabtai Cohen, this great, great rabbi, lived in the mid-1600s. He actually passed away very, very young. He passed away at the age of 42. That he comes up with the idea of mechira chametz. He comes up with the idea of, let's sell the chametz that we have, so that way we don't have the chametz over Pesach. The reason why is because it was an absolute necessity. The Jews were managing. Not to mention, Jews are very trustworthy by and large. Let's forget about Madoff right now. But Jews are very trustworthy, especially in Poland at that time. Us Jews, the only thing we want to be left alone. We will do whatever you want. As we saw in Arab lands, we'll pay the jizya, we'll go ahead, we'll pay the tax. Just leave us alone. Let us be autonomous, let us run our own, you know, state within a state. That's why it's not a mistake that over here in Poland, they have something called the Vad Arba Arzos, which was a very powerful, they used to meet, I think, twice a year at a big fair. There's a lot of amazing stories. And these were the people that were in charge of Poland at this time. And what happens is that these nobles, they wanted these trustworthy Jews, they wanted the Jews to run everything. And that's exactly what happened. And the Jews were, they were 100% okay. It was this amazing symbiotic relationship. And even though Poland was Catholic, and you would think Catholics, especially 1600s, not so into Jews, they also, they found this to be particularly advantageous. They were very happy about this. They said, listen, this is working out very, very well. Let's continue. And they were very happy with it. And even though there were pogroms, there were certain things that happened, nevertheless, overall, things were fantastic. None of it was ever state-sanctioned, and that's a very, very, very big deal. Unlike Germany, which, you know, every other Tuesday you have another, you know, Jewish community getting kicked out of there, you know, moving on to the next town in Germany. So Poland was a particularly stable place, and it's not a mistake that there's an amazing amount of scholarship, an amazing amount of culture. Jews thrive there. They become very, very wealthy. They become important. They're incredible. What happens is, this completely changes. In Tachvatat 1648, with Bogdan Chmelnitsky. I definitely spelled it wrong, but there's no right way to spell it in English. My wife has been to Ukraine six times? Seven times? Six times? Yeah? Not? Are you sleeping? I'm sorry. She hears me too often. So what happens is that she went to Ukraine and she was shocked. She's walking around and what does she see? This ugly dude, Bogdan, this horrible person, but yet this huge statue of Chmelnitsky. Why? Because in Ukraine, he's viewed as a George Washington. He's viewed as the main person that got them away from all sorts of Polish rule, from the magnates, from the nobles. This was the Cossack uprising of 1648. And as we just discussed, the Jews were very close to the nobles. They're willing to be part of the symbiotic deal. Obviously, who's going to end up with major, major problems when the Cossacks start this uprising? The Jews. And it becomes horrible. And there's all sorts of statistics, especially nowadays. There's a huge fight. Originally, it said 500,000 Jews got killed. Now they're starting to say 12,000 Jews got killed. Whatever the point is, it was a very, very, very big, very, very, very big percentage of Jews in Poland that end up getting killed. And it's awful. It's absolutely terrible for the Jews. The Shah, there's a famous... up until World War II, there was even a fast day on one of the days that Tachvatat, I think it was the day it was even started, Professor J.J. Schafter of YU, he has an amazing, amazing shiur and essay about this, where he talks all about how this was a fast day that was done all the way up until World War II. Because World War II, once that happened, all bets are off. That was the worst. But starting from 1648 all the way to 1939, 1945, there was a fast day that was kept to honor these people that were killed during these Chmelnytsky massacres, during this horrible time. And what happens is that there's a tremendous amount of despair. And what happens is that you actually end up, a few years later, 1666, Chabad Tzvi. People are at the low point in their lives, and therefore they're looking to hook up onto anything. So Shabtai Tzvi, starting off in Israel, in Gaza, and then later on in Turkey, and Smyrna, going to different places, he ends up fooling the entire world. Everyone was fooled by Shabtai Tzvi. I mean, there were a few people. There was someone, Rav Yaakov Sasportas, the Sephardic chief rabbi of Amsterdam. He was not fooled. And he wrote an entire sefer called Tzitzat Novel Tzvi. There was an entire sefer against him, but everyone thought, nah, you're wrong. He is Mashiach. Even some of the rabbis that didn't believe he was Mashiach, they still said it's awesome that so many people are doing tshuva. So many people want to get closer to God. So therefore, we're not going to say anything. We're not going to say we don't think Shabbat Tzvi is Mashiach. The Taz, who was this huge, huge rabbi, the Turei Zav, Rav David Siegel, who's living, or Segal, who's living in Poland at the time, his amazing commentary, the Taz, the Turei Zav, he also wrote another Sefer on Chumash called the Divrei David, he sends three of his kids to Shabtai Tzvi to go test him. Is he the Mashiach or not? This is the Gadol Ador. He actually ends up passing away in 1667, so he obviously can't do the travel himself. He sends the three kids, and they come back. They say, you know what? He's Mashiach. They 100% agree. Shabtai Tzvi, according to Gershom Shalom, he was bipolar. He had times of great happiness and amazingness, and he also had times when he was in, you know, a major depression. They use all sorts, in all of the documents, they use Kabbalistic terms, which is fascinating. Like, they'll say, like, you know, the sadness in some sort of, like, mystical way. It's very interesting. So what happens is that Jews, they want to do something, and they want to latch on to this, and they do. In Amsterdam, Jews went ahead and sold everything they had because they literally thought that Shabtai Tzvi was there, and therefore all they were waiting for were the boats. They already got tickets, and they sold things at rock bottom prices to the non-Jews in Amsterdam. It created a huge disaster. Many Jews were hurt. Not to mention, this was the end of rabbinic prestige. especially with the next generation, when you talk about Rav Yaakov Emden, you talk about Rav Yossi Naivashitz, but Shabtai Tzvi was really the end. Before then, the rabbi was incredible, the rabbi was amazing. After that, no way, not at all. So there are a few different approaches to why Chassidus spread. The first one I want to discuss is by Professor Simon Dubnov. Simon Dubnov, he died in 1941. He was actually killed by the Nazis, by the Gestapo. According to the story, he was actually killed by one of his former students. He taught in I think in Riga and all sorts of other different places. In Petrograd, he taught also in the University of Petrograd. So he was a big professor, and he was one of the first ones to really write about Chassidus and what really caused Chassidus to happen. And he says, because of the revolts, because of the Cossack revolts, because of Khmelnytsky, that's why Chassidus was able to flourish, and that's exactly what happened. Because what happens when bad things happen to you, where do you look? You look inward. Turkey, for example, the Ottoman Empire in the 1800s, they underwent an entire thing called Tanzimat, which was an entire whole bunch of reforms that they tried doing because they realized that they were losing so much to the Western powers. They said, we have to look internally. What are we doing wrong? For example, a lot of the recent jihad that's going on now, why is it there's a state of Israel? It shouldn't be that land that was once owned by Muslims should ever fall to the Jews. So therefore, where are they going to look? They're going to look internally. Maybe we're not from enough. Maybe we're not doing the right thing. Maybe we're not really for Allah so much. And therefore, you look internally. It's the same thing going on over here, according to Dubnov. He's saying Jews look internally, and therefore, what did they find? What they wanted to do is that they wanted to latch on to something. So the rabbis at the time, the only thing that they know is halakha. So if you look at books from around this time, it's very, very rigid halachot books. That obviously can't inspire Jews that are so low. It's not going to do it. So therefore, Chassidus was able to enter, and then end up spreading like wildfire, and therefore people became Chassidish. And therefore, the Baal Shem was a major revolutionary. Because like we mentioned, he's stressing love, he's stressing prayer, he's stressing all these different types of things, and that's a big deal because he's a major, major, major revolutionary, according to Dubnov. The next person I want to talk about is Professor Benzion Dinur. He was a huge Zionist. He grew up very religious. He went to Telz. He learned by Rav Shimon Shkab, and he also learned in Slobodka. Later on, as I'm sure you could tell, he didn't keep the Orthodox part. But he was a very, very big scholar, eventually ending up in Hebrew U. And he says something very similar to Dubnov, but different. He says the rabbis at that time were very close to nobility. So therefore, since they were so close, a lot of these rabbis, for example, were chosen in concert with the nobility who were owning all of these lands. In terms of, they own all of Poland, they own the town of Krakow. You want to hire a rabbi of Krakow? It also has to be good according to the noble. So therefore, once people saw that the rabbis were at the teat of I don't know if that's the proper word, but basically that they're beholden to the nobility. And once the nobility is seen to be corrupt and gone and everything and horrible, therefore it ends up being that the rabbis also lose their prestige. And therefore, you know, you can't go towards the rabbis. And who filled the void? It was the Baal Shem. The Baal Shem filled the void, and therefore, once again, the Baal Shem was a major, major revolutionary because people were turned off by the rabbis. Very similar to what we said according to Dubnov. Dubnov said that they were turned off by the halakha. Here they're turned off by all sorts of graft and all sorts of other types of things, much more negative. And therefore, he was a major revolutionary. The next professor is Professor Gershom Shalom. As I mentioned before, he holds everything is particularly Sabbatean. And he says that after Shabtai Tzvi, now Gershom Shalom was interesting. He was actually granted admission when he was a young student into Beit El Yeshiva. Beit El Yeshiva was the top, I don't know anymore, but it was the top Kabbalist yeshiva. It's actually in the Old City. They have a beautiful door. I don't know if you've ever been in the Old City. This gorgeous silver door as you're walking through. It's gorgeous. It's Beit El Yeshiva. It's incredible. So he, Gershom Shalom, he comes up with a different theory. He says it has to come from Shabtai Tzvi, but he says, what was the reaction to Shabtai Tzvi? He says, number one, People just ignored it. They said this was a big thing that happened. Shabbat Shvi came along. Let's ignore whatever sort of gains we did mystically. Forget about everything. And let's just go back to how we think it should be. Number two is that you could make it exclusive. And that's actually what people did. That's why at this time there's a big rise in cloises. Cloises are private study houses where people learn mysticism. And therefore they say, let's bring Kabbalah away from the masses and let's move it back. Let's have it become elite and exclusive again. However, according to Gershom Shalom, what did the Baal Shem do? The Baal Shem said, let's continue with the mysticism. But what do we have to divorce the mysticism from? Messianism. If we take away Messianism from Sabbateanism, what do you end up with? A huge love of mysticism. And he says that that is Hasidus. And he says that's why the Baal Shem came, and that's why his ideas gained so much traction, because they were open to it because of Shabtai Tzvi. Because of Shabtai Tzvi. According to Shalom, a lot of the Hasidus was able to maintain the Kabbalah. You maintain, for example, the structure of having a tzaddik, of having the Rebbe, but he's not Messiah, and that's a very, very, very big deal. So once again, according to Gershom Shalom, the Baal Shem Tov was revolutionary because he took this idea of Sabbateanism. He said, let's move away Messianism, and therefore we'll have this amazing, amazing thing called Hasidus. So that's what everyone thought up until a few years ago, up until 1978. So all these three approaches show that he was a major, that the Baal Shem was a major, major revolutionary, this huge, huge person. Yet, most of the stuff that a lot of these people are relying on are secondary documents. Like, for example, you know, like the Shibchei Abesh that we mentioned before. So there's a fourth way. There's actually a fifth way by Professor Yaffa Elias, but no one likes that one at all. And this fourth way really started in 1978. This is the only academic book I've ever seen where Professor Rosman, he's of Bar Ilan. He actually writes an introduction. He says that he's religious. He writes that he's from. He actually, you can see, he's got a keep over there. But he writes he's from because he says that some of the stuff that he's going to write in this book is going to upset people, or at least he thinks might upset people. And most certainly it did. It did upset a few people. So Bezalel Ner, oh, so let's just talk a bit more. So what he was able to find, let's talk about what he was able to find. In 1978, he took a look at the tax documents and he saw that the Baal Shem was given his house tax-free, completely by the community. Now, if I were to ask you, if someone is such a revolutionary, are they going to go ahead and get tax-free housing? And not to mention, a lot of his other family is quoted, are found in this registry and other types of very interesting things. What is it? What Rosman wants to say, and this is incredible, is that you can't say that the Besh was such a revolutionary. In later times, in 1850, when Shimcha Besh was written, there's all this opposition to him in Mezhbezh and opposition to him in other places. However, during his own lifetime, Rosman shows something amazing. He shows that he was completely accepted, loved by the community, and not to mention, he's called doctor. If you take a look at page, it should be the second page, look at the second page. It says on the top, page 165. He produces between 1739 and 1763 what's going on at this house. So 1739, Kahal house in which the Moscow was the clergyman, fine. 1740, Kahal or Cantor's house in which there is a Kabbalist. 1742, the Baal Shem in the Kahal house. The Kahal house, completely tax-free. 1758, Balzum, Baal Shem, he's in the Kahal house. 1760, Balzum, Dr. Lieber, the Baal Shem, the doctor is exempt. 1763, Hersko in the Kahal house. Now, this is amazing, because when did the Baal Shem pass away? 1760! That's why he's not living in this house anymore. What Raza wants to show is that he was not so much of a mahapech. He was not so much a revolutionary during his own time, based on what we said about the Baal Shem, based on the fact that he's called doctor, based on the fact that in his own time he was loved. and he was able to get stuff tax-free from the government, he was not necessarily the revolutionary that he's made out to be in later years. Now, I will tell you, there's a person from Muncie, his name is Bassal Nair, or Bassal Naor. He wrote in a review, and I'll quote it, this is awesome. He writes, "This must be, you know, absurd," because he says, what do you end up doing? He says, "You're reducing a world-class theologian to the information provided on his tax return." He says that. However, I don't know, to me, I don't know, maybe, I mean, Rosman, the whole book is incredible. I'm a huge, huge fan. People have told me that they don't ask me for what I think about books anymore, because I think every book is good. So, like, take it with a bissel of salt again. Take it with a bissel. Yet Professor Rosman, with his expertise on the Polish area, because remember, he's not a scholar of Hasidus. He's not like Dubnov, he's not like Dinor, he's not like Shalom. He has nothing to do with that. He cares more about magnates, about nobles, about Poland. He cares more about that. So he says, you could tell from what was going on in Poland that in reality the Baal Shem wasn't necessarily this huge revolutionary. He says, for example, during the 1700s, you're right, during 1648, things were terrible. However, things got significantly better. In the year 1700, Poland was actually able to get Podolia back from the Ottoman Empire. And that was a very big deal. Not to mention, he says something amazing that I think is very cogent. And let me show you a picture. This is, I think, is the last picture we have. This over here is Yeshiva Chachmei Lublin in Lublin, Rav Meir Shapira. If you go in there, supposedly the person that provided the stones, the marble on the ground, is the same person that provided the marble to Yeshiva University, which was, that building was made in 1929. That's why that famous picture has Rav Shimon Shkop, who that one year in 1929, he wasn't the Rosh Yeshiva of Tel Aviv, he was Rosh Yeshiva of YU, and yes, in 1929 it did become a college. So if anyone wants to say, Shimon Shkop, he didn't know it was going to become a college, it was a college, whatever, he didn't want to go back, the Chafetz Chaim made him come back, whatever, this is all major, major tangents, I apologize. Okay, so if you're building, now very unfortunately, this, I think it was dedicated in 1933, I'm pretty sure. Nowadays, I didn't even want to bring a modern picture, but it's definitely not a yeshiva anymore. If you are happy with where you are, you lay roots. You build beautiful edifices. You're not afraid to go ahead and build gorgeous shuls. Rosman shows that in Poland, all of these issues, all of these stuff about getting kicked out, all these stuff about the Chmielnicki massacres, it was over by the 1700s. And therefore, you want to say people were in such a low level? He says it's not true. He says things were fine. So therefore, what exactly was so amazing about Hasidus? What was it? Because if we're saying already right now that he's not a revolutionary, what exactly did the Baal Shem contribute? What did he do? So what most people, I mean, this is what Rosman wants to say, and it's incredible. He says that there always existed this idea of a chassid. There always existed, and it's very similar to something that we mentioned before. There was always this idea of a chassid, always. For example, the Chassidei Ashkenaz, Rebbe Yehuda HaChassid, the famous Sefer Chassidim, he was one of the German pietists in the 1200s. There always existed this type of pietistic movement. What the Baal Shem did is that the Baal Shem brought it towards people, but it's not even necessarily him. And this is what Rosman says. Rosman says, when do all of these things come up? All these things are all told 2 generations later. What happens during the 3rd generation of Hasidus? What you have is that you have Shneur Zalman of Liadi. He's fighting very, very strong. I don't want to say fighting, but what he's doing is disagreeing very strongly with the Vilna Gaon about what exactly is going to be the future of Judaism. Remember, the Vilna Gaon is called HaGaon HaChassid. The Vilna Gaon is also called a Chassid. You know why? Because he used to roll around in the snow. Because he used to go ahead and do all sorts of stuff. He went ahead and traveled around Europe anonymously, doing something called Galut, doing Gullus, doing stuff like this, because he was part of this Hamshacha. He was part of this German pietistic movement. But the Baal Shem, according to Rosman, is that he became the figure that people pointed to after and said, he's what started. He's the one that started it, but yet he never necessarily did anything himself. It is the next 2 generations. It is Tolos Yaakov Yosef who records it. It's the Magid who goes ahead and sends his Talmidim and sends them with the learnings and the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov. that those people, they're the ones to go ahead and really spread Hasidut throughout the world. Rosman also takes issue. So he says it was really formulated later. So this is really where I want to end, and this will basically end my speaking to you guys this year. I'm very unfortunate about. I always like finding shalom. Like, one of my favorite teachers in the entire world, his name is Dr. Lyman. Dr. Sayer Lyman of Queens, now of YU. He lives in Queens. He's incredible. So he one time gave an amazing, amazing shiur, and it's a famous article in Tradition, where he basically bashes. He says the entire concept that the Maharal, I'm sure you guys learned about this last week, it's not true. He didn't make a golem. But the way he ends his essay is beautiful. You know what he says? He says, he might not have created a golem, but you know what he did create? He created the Tosfos Yontif, who happens to be one of his Talmidim, who ends up being, it's much harder to create an amazing student than build some sort of mystical golem. So the way I would like to end with our shiur today is that the Baal Shem attracted, and his students attracted, some of the best people in the entire world. Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, this great Talmudist, this great learner, he was given an opportunity. Should I go to the Gra? Should I go to Vilna Gaon to learn? Or should I go to the Magen Mezerich? And what happened was, is that he said, I'm already a pretty good learner. But you know what? I still don't know how to daven. And he went to the Magen Mezerich. And he went ahead and he learned by him and he became a chassid. The point is that you could tell how amazing a person is, even if you want to accept everything Rosman is saying, that maybe he wasn't this big revolutionary. Nevertheless, the people that the Baal Shem was able to attract, that he was able to attract, were top, elite, amazing people. And even though, as he shows over and over again, you could poke holes historically in most of the documents about the Baal Shem, what you cannot disagree with, and he doesn't write it in here, but what you cannot disagree with are the amazing people that coalesce around him and really start this amazing mapecha that does start this revolution. Whether or not it started in the early 1700s by the Baal Shem, or whether or not it started in the 1790s, it doesn't make a difference. What Chassidus has brought to us, to a certain, which is absolutely amazing, this ahava, this love, this joy, getting us out of the doldrums, is absolutely amazing. Thank you so much.